So, okay, here's my argument. You got a better one? Let me hear it. All right, and we'll go back and forth, and we'll see who wins. And I got to tell you, in 20-plus years on Fox and in the last year and a half on BillO'Reilly.com, nobody ever beat me. A couple of, there were a couple of draws. Charles Krauthammer, the late Charles Krauthammer, and I had some epic debates.
Yeah.
But nobody ever beat me because I would go in armed and dangerous with facts.
Right.
And with historical context. But now it's too annoying. You know, people, I don't want to hear that. I want to hear what I believe. No matter, my belief may be fallacious. It may be wrong. May be based on nothing. But I don't want to hear the opposite.
Because we want to be affirmed.
That's what you see on TV now.
Welcome to the Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
The Disruption Zone. I'm Leland Conway, along with Cameron Mills. We have a super special guest today, Cameron.
Big time.
We have Bill O'Reilly. He has written, like, I don't know, like 1,000 books on history and leadership, which is pretty
14
awesome.
14 by my count, and that may be, I may be one or two off.
Yeah. Bill, how are you?
Good, Leland. Just for the record, 15 number one bestsellers.
I was off one.
Including Killing the SS, which is just out. Number
awesome.
One this coming Sunday on the New York Times list. So thanks for mentioning it, and congrats on a podcast.
Well, we're having a blast with this, and I want to come back to the book. We're going to spend some time on that and some of the others that you've written, because the idea of this podcast is disrupting the norms, and I think the leaders that you have covered, the people, the groups, the different things, that the historical events have been disrupting events. Let's start with this. I mean, everybody knows you left Fox News. Is there a part of that story that you feel like wasn't told properly?
Sure, but I'm not litigating it in the media. We have done very well in the courts, and all I can say is what I said in my original statement. The whole thing was bogus. I mistreated no one. They made a decision based on business reasons. Anybody investigating will find that out fairly easily. But for me to drag that out is not a positive thing in any way.
And you are obviously back on the scene. What lessons have you taken from that whole event in how you're approaching, you know, what's going on in your life now?
Well, what we did immediately was form a news organization on BillO'Reilly.com because you have that technology now that you can do just like you're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So we did what we did it before you did it, but it's the same thing. Is basically reaching people without a corporate structure. So that affords me a number of opportunities because I don't have to answer to anybody. I run the operation. Mm. We do 30 minutes of analysis every night to subscribers, and we have a very successful thing going, which has been from the jump. I took 5 people over from Fox. Staff is very good. We don't make mistakes. We don't have partisan craziness. Mm. We give you the straight story as we see it every day, backed up by facts. And then in addition, I write books that are very successful, so I'm busy. There wasn't one day when I woke up and said, gee, I'm really wish I could go back into the corporate environment and do what I did for more than 20 years. I enjoyed it while I did it, but I had had enough. And if you watch cable news now or network news, you see how it's changed, how it's all about Trump. You either hate him or love him.
Right.
And to me, that's boring. I'm really not interested in that.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I'm where I am.
Bill, you mentioned the word partisan. We had actually Senator McConnell on yesterday. I think we're going to release that today. But like right in the middle of this election thing, you've been a part of the political media, I guess, for years. Senator McConnell said, you know what, if you do your research, things have been more partisan before. What's your take on that? I mean, do you look at how we are as a country now, and are we more split now than we've ever been, or is that just part of history that we don't know about?
Well, you can make an argument, obviously, that in the Civil War you were regionally separated by the issues of slavery and the economy, tariffs. So obviously that's there. And then in the Vietnam era, the country was split. About you know, whether we should support this war and the social norms that were changing, or we should throw out the people who got us into this mess and have a new way. So there were two other times in history at this level. But now it's a little bit different, because what you have is a largely uneducated population, in the sense that they don't understand history. That's why I write these history books, so millions will read them and get it. And they are under the sway of a corrupt media. Now, the media has always been shaky and partisan, but not like today. So there's millions and millions of dollars at stake. And the chieftains have said, well, if you're on CNN, you have to hate Trump. That's it. Because that's where our audience is. 90% of our audience who watches CNN votes Democrat, so you're going to hate him if you want to work here. Same thing at Fox. If you 95% of Fox viewers vote Republican, so you got to stick up for Trump. Now, a couple of exceptions at Fox. It's not quite as doctrinaire as CNN. Of course, MSNBC is off the chart liberal, but it's still, they're playing to a different crew. They're not trying to give you information where you can make your own assessment. They're partisans, and they're advancing what they think is going to make them money. That's a big mistake people make. They think that, well, this is all about ideology. It's all about money.
Right.
So that division in the media plays out on the internet, because everybody can be a pundit on the internet, and then the hatred rises, and that's what you see.
When I first started out, Bill, and I started on journalism, and now I'm a commentator, which is very different, as you know. But I had I've always been conservative in my ideology, and my boss was super, super liberal. To this day, we're great friends. He brought me into the newsroom and he said, listen, Leland, you're going to have bias. That's part of who you are. But what we expect from you is to be fair. One thing I think that you always have always presented throughout your career is that you call it as you see it, not as a talking point sees it. What changed in media to make it so doctrinaire, and how do we fix it?
Well, a couple of things changed. Number one, the standards dropped. So I was just watching on cable TV the run-up of the coverage to the vote, okay? Now, I wrote a message of the day on BillO'Reilly.com this morning and said, don't watch any coverage until 7 p.m. Eastern time. Do not turn on the news.
That's great
Why?
Advice.
Yeah, it is.
This is what I got in the last 10 minutes before I'm talking to you guys. Here's a Fox anchor. Quote, balance of power in Washington is on the line. I think everybody knows that. All right? I think. Everyone knows. All right? So I'm listening to something. That would be like saying, if you have a house, you have a roof. Okay, I got it. That's what a house is. Okay, 3 seconds later on another network, CNN, both parties want a good outcome. Thanks. Thanks a lot. All right, now these people are being paid.
Yes.
They're being paid money to go on and say this stupid stuff. All right? So what has changed is that when I was moving the factor up into the number one position for 16 years, I told my staff, don't book dumb people. And they had to give me a point of view from each guest. Mm. Each guest had a jacket, a file, that was handed to me in the afternoon before we went on the air. And I could read their point of view. I still do that on BillO'Reilly.com with our guests. Mm. And if the point of view was stupid, I would call the producer, the booker, and say, no, if they don't have anything else, get someone else. Mm. But you don't have that now. It's like anybody can say anything. CNN's got 16 people sitting there on a panel. You don't know who they are. They say something, and somebody yells at them, right. And you're going, oh, my God, why am I watching this? You know, can I do sit-ups? Isn't there anything else I can do?
It'd be healthier.
So standards have dropped through the floor. And at the network news, you got people who are 23, 24 years old named Bambi out there covering stories that can't even pronounce the names. I mean, I worked for CBS and ABC Network. I mean, it was rigorous.
Yeah.
You couldn't make a mistake.
Did you see the lady that set up with MSNBC the other day and blocked a voting polling place, two handicapped spots, and kept veterans?
Yeah, I saw it.
And you got veterans. I'm like, what are you doing? You know, it's like they have this sort of heir apparent of whatever they. I think that's gotten under people's skin, Bill, in a big way.
Well, the deterioration of the American media and the corruption of it is a major story in this country. But, of course, the media is not going to tell it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it would be like, oh, we got to report on ourselves. And I'm sitting here now. I'm out of it. And I was in it for 45 years. All right. And when I started, it was right after Watergate. And so I've seen the devolution of this industry, and it's a shame. It really is a shame what has happened.
Bill, we'll get into your book next, but I just want one more comment. That's, I think, the most frustrating thing to me is that everybody's got some accountability. You know, if you're a husband, you've got some accountability with your wife. If you work, if you're an employee, you've got an accountability with your employer. Who does the media, I mean, who is their accountability? Who do they answer to? Because when and I get it, Trump can criticize them harshly, but when anyone criticizes them, they seem to circle the wagons and protect the whole endeavor. Because to my way of thinking, it's like you go, it's the money. It's not necessarily the ideology. It's the clicks. It's the views. It's the advertisements. It's the money that hurts more than anything.
Well, unlike sports, where you come from, Cameron, there's no performance bar on the media. You got to understand that. So it's all about who can bring in people to watch. Now, in my opinion, there really isn't, you know, there's a few exceptions, a few what they call rainmakers, people who are iconic and then Americans want to watch them for one reason or another, but very few. It's almost like Hollywood. It used to be John Wayne, Clint Eastwood, Sean Connery. Could open movies. People would go just to see them. They don't really care what the movie was. Now that there isn't anyone in Hollywood who can do that. No one. It's on TV. You have a variety of people not being paid much money. They're cutting salaries all over the place. That's why Megyn Kelly got booted. And you have no accountability in the sense of you can say any stupid stuff you want, but nobody's going to come down from on high and say, you know, you really got to wise up here. You got to give me a little bit more. Because it's they can sell their ads, they can get their subscription rates on cable, and it's, you know, the quality, it really doesn't matter. Now, if you're in a sport, then you lose every night,
yeah,
then you're obviously in trouble and people aren't going to come watch you.
That's right.
So there is accountability on the court or on the football field, but not in the media.
Yeah.
If you get low ratings, yeah, you're going to get booted, but that takes a while.
All right, well, let's get into a different type of media, and that's your books. How did you come up with the title or the idea behind your Killing series? Because I can't think of a more provocative name for a book or a series of books other than Killing Christ, Killing Kennedy, Killing the SS, which is your new one. Where did that come from?
Well, I had written a bunch of books on contemporary America, and they all have been very, very successful. The O'Reilly Factor, No Spin Zone, Culture Warrior. But then pretty much I had said all that I had to say in print. And I'm a former high school history teacher. I always loved history. So I said, you know what? I'm going to get into this industry because I want to tell people stories about what happened in an entertaining way, not in a boring way. You got 800 pages on Andrew Jackson. Who's going to read that? You know, not even Andrew Jackson's ancestors are going to read it.
History professor,
so I came up with the concept first, and I went to the publisher and said, no more nonfiction books on contemporized. I'm going to do history. And they looked at me and said, you're crazy. There's a million history books. And I said, not only is that, I want to do a book on Lincoln first. I want that to be the first one. They go, come on, there's a million books on Lincoln. I said, but not the way I write them. So I got the best researcher in the world, Martin Dugard,
right.
And then I had to come up with a name. So to get people's attention on TV and the movies, records, books, whatever it may be, you gotta market it, and you gotta have a snappy, upfront title that people will remember.
Yep.
So I'm writing a book on Lincoln, right? What's the big event on Lincoln? He was assassinated. Bing, 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 Killing Lincoln. Now, I didn't have an idea of another Killing book because nobody knew that this was going to be successful. In fact, I took a lot less money to write Killing Lincoln than I was earning on the other contemporary books. Mm. But I decided to take a chance. And then when Lincoln went through the roof, then it was, okay, who are we going to kill
next?
Who do you want to write about next? All right? And then now Killing the SS is the eighth in the Killing series, eighth book, 19 million copies in print, the most successful nonfiction book series of all time. So it was just a matter of sitting down and marketing, and I figured that title was simple, right to the point, would grab everybody's attention.
Certainly did.
But it reads like a spy thriller in a way, because you have this enormous story. I don't think a lot of people realize what happened once the war was over. And then you have these war criminals that dispersed all over the world, a lot of them to South America. And they don't realize that the nation of Israel chased them down.
Years later, even.
This is a fascinating story, this latest one that you've written.
Well, I mean, we try to choose subjects. We have two more killing books to deliver. We know what we're going to write about.
Can you share that today?
We try to choose subjects where people have an interest. All right? So people have an interest in World War II, Nazi Party. There's an inherent interest in people over the age of 50, all right, which is your book-buying public.
Right.
And then Dugard starts to research. Books take a year to write. And he digs out stuff that hasn't been written before and isn't known before. Like, we found this woman in San Francisco who had been there for 50 years, who was one of the most evil concentration camp guards in Germany, a woman SS member. She comes to the USA on a refugee visa, marries a Jew, lives in San Francisco. Everybody thinks she's the greatest person in the world. Finally, they get her, all right? The State Department tracks her. Brings her back to Germany, where she's still alive today, and gets a U.S. Social Security check every month. It's amazing. So those are the kinds of stories that I put into these books that nobody knows about, and then I write them like Patterson writes his book in thriller way, because that's the kind of books I like to read. It's not turgid, slow, and boring. It zooms through. So that's the successful formula we have.
What is, and you can use any of your killing books to answer this question, Bill, but of course, Killing the SS being the one that's out now. What is the biggest shock that you have learned in the research that your partner has done or that you have done? What's the story that you know, you just mentioned the one about the lady that's still alive today drawing a Social Security check that was an SS criminal in Nazi Germany. But what's another story that you're like, people don't know this, and I didn't know this. It shocked me.
Well, I'll give you two examples. One, in Killing the SS, is the last chapter of the book, which I don't talk about in the media because I don't want to spoil it for the reader. But that's truly shocking.
Okay.
The way we end Killing the SS is truly shocking. It has to do with Israel and its relationship with a big-time Nazi. The other one was in Killing Lincoln, the first book, where we found out that Abraham Lincoln's son, Robert, all right, had a relationship with a woman who was engaged to John Wilkes Booth.
Come on.
Whoa.
I did not know that. Nobody knew it.
Whoa.
And now we believe that Wilkes Booth found out that he was being two-timed by his fiance with Lincoln's son. And that partially drove him. To commit the murder.
Wow.
So those are two big ones.
So it wasn't just political. It was political and then
personal. It was personal for Wilkes Booth.
Wow.
And we documented pretty solid there, and I've never seen that in any Lincoln.
Yeah. Wow. These events that you cover with the SS series are all disruptive
events. Killing series.
The Killing series. They're all disruptive, right? I mean, obviously chasing down Nazi SS. Killing the president who many people would argue is one of the greatest presidents of all time and one of the great leaders in world history. I mean, Abraham Lincoln was on path to do Reconstruction in a way that our country might have turned out very different, and the 1964 civil rights movement might have happened in 1902 instead of 1964. It was on target for that kind of thing. These were disruptive events. What do you pull out of that for people in terms of, like, contextually, how you understand what I'm getting at, like, here with building disruptive events? You understand what I'm getting at here? Just trying to pull out of these lessons that you think, well, this is a great leadership lesson for the next generation.
Well, look, when you look at what's happening in America today, all right, you have a split. The older population, I would say 50 and up, all right, they grasp really what's going on in the country, in the sense that, okay, you either want border security or you don't. There's no in-between. So the Republican Party wants it, the Democratic Party does not. You either want capitalism, robust capitalism, or you don't. You want a different kind of share the land cap, you know, that's socialism. So it's when you're dealing with people, when I deal with younger Americans, I assume, and I'm not being supercilious, word of the day, I'm not being arrogant, I assume they don't know what's happening in Cuba.
Yeah.
All right, I've been to Cuba. I saw it. I was in Eastern Europe when Soviets controlled it. I was in Romania. Okay, I was in Hungary. I saw it. I know what it is. But they don't. So that you have, you know, when you talk about disruption, there's two types of disruption. Educated disruption, where you basically say, this is wrong and I'm going to try to change it. Or uneducated disruption, which is anarchy, which is Antifa, you know, which are the neo-Nazis. That's uneducated. All right. So, yeah, it's around in America. It's not at the level now where, I mean, Trump is obviously a disruptor. No doubt about it. All right. But it's not at the level where it's being, it's destructive to our lives on a day-to-day basis. But it's certainly destructive to relationships.
You mentioned, because we can tie this to your books and to your earlier conversation about the media and the state of the country in terms of divisiveness. Context. And I've said that, one of the things that I think is truly missing from today's debate is context. You just mentioned young people don't know what Cuba. They say, oh, Che Guevara. They're wearing their Che Guevara T-shirt.
Right.
Or they're running around talking about how great Hugo Chavez is. And our celebrities are going down there and visiting these people. These are cesspool countries run – not the people. I'm not saying the people are cesspool. I'm saying their government.
They have been run into that.
Have been run into cesspool governments with these, like, these dictatorships. And we don't have that context. How do we get that back? I mean, in a way, your books are kind of pulling that in by saying, hey, look, history, the Nazis, what they did, it was horrible, you know, killing Lincoln, etc., killing Jesus. How do we get that back and get younger people to pay attention to context so when they're making decisions, they know what's happening?
It's impossible. You can't get it back. And that's because of the machines. So it's painful to educate yourself. It's painful to go to work every day, and particularly if you're not really in love with your job. I mean, these are unpleasant things to do 3 hours of homework, all right, and to learn a skill. It's hard to do those things. If you do them, you'll succeed in America. That's the game. We'll give you the opportunity to succeed, but you have to work hard and be honest. You can't wind up in a penitentiary. But the younger people, they don't want to pay that price because they're texting and they're going to websites and they're playing Fortnite. Whatever the hell they're doing, all right? And it's at the fingertip. It's not like you don't have to go, you don't have to go out to the movies, or you don't have to go bowling. You don't have to shoot baskets. You don't have to leave the house. When I was a kid in Levittown, Long Island, there were hundreds of kids. The ball fields were finished. You ride down, my ride down in my old neighborhood, there's nobody out, even on a beautiful day. Nobody's throwing a ball around. Where are they? They're texting, or they're on their games. They don't have to leave the house. And why don't their parents make them? Because their parents are texting. That's why. All right? And you think, I mean, I'm making fun of it.
No.
But this is fundamentally separating aware Americans, those who want to go to Harvard, okay, from the texting crew.
Yeah.
And you're going to see in the next 10 to 20 years, huge divide between the educated, affluent America and everybody else who's just getting by because they don't want to pay the price.
Bill, as someone who loves history, and I'm excited that Killing SS came out. I'm getting ready to go on vacation, and I can't wait to, on the way down and on the beach in the next couple of weeks, tear this book apart because I love World War II history. But what I love about it are the lessons that you learn. I mean, that when you study World War II, you realize Hitler was actually elected democratically. Now, then he took over. But he wasn't dictator from beginning, though that's what he always wanted. As someone who loves history and someone who looks at this generation and says they're texting, they don't care, they don't know, surely there's got to be an answer to educate them from a historical point of view of where we've been as a society and as a world using this new technology they've got. There's got to be something we can do.
That's an excellent point, Cameron. You can use it and harness it to educate. I took my son, 15 years old, addicted to the machine, but I'm on him, okay? I'm on him.
You're a parent.
So I regulate it. So I took him to Charleston, South Carolina last weekend. Okay? And we have a cousin down there who was a Vietnam War hero. So I wanted my son to sit with him and talk about the Vietnam War and his experiences, which happened. At the same time, I dragged him and wouldn't let him take his machine out of the hotel room. The machine had to stay in the drawer. I dragged him around Charleston, one of the most historic cities in the country, and I explained to him how the Revolutionary War went down in the city, and then dragged him out to Fort Moultrie and the Civil War. Okay, so that was all one day. And he was walking it and seeing it, and I was with him. All right, and we walked right through it. A tremendous day. Now, in 2 days in Charleston, he learned an enormous amount, and actually even forgot about the machine until he got back in the room. And then he dove into it and grabbed it and kissed it.
But all right? He's had some education.
Yeah. So the grandparents and parents of America got to be cognizant of, if you care about the younger generation, you're going to have to force them out of this thing, this technological thing, and into real life, at least part of the time. And I don't see it happening because I don't think most Americans understand the ramifications of this high-tech availability to everybody at their fingertips. I don't think they know. It's coming and it's coming
fast. Which was supposed to be the whole point of this machine, as Bill calls it, was supposed to be instant access to information.
Right.
And it's become instant access to entertainment. I mean, and that's the side most people are faulting to is the entertainment instead of the information.
Yeah, it's so stimulating.
Yeah.
These games are so stimulating, and some of the websites, you know, fantasy football, whatever it may
be.
Okay, that you don't have the patience to go out and play a game anymore. You know, my kids don't even watch TV anymore.
Yeah,
and they don't even watch TV.
Doesn't this tie
because
in?
Because it's too slow.
Right. Yeah, well, that's a great point. I mean, too slow. That's why, like, YouTube is 3 minutes. Boom, boom, boom. Doesn't this tie?
Yeah.
Doesn't this tie into the beginning of our conversation about the divisiveness too? When you know everybody has their podcast, everybody has their website. There's so many fractured ways that people can get information that we tend to burrow into our own tunnel. I just want to be affirmed in my point of view rather than listen to a guy or a gal who has a completely different point of view. So it's so easy for us to be affirmed.
It's too annoying.
Yeah.
See, people don't want to be annoyed anymore. They're almost numb to that.
Right.
So I like the robust debate. I mean, I want to be challenged. I want, you know, that's part of the success of my media operation. So, okay, here's my argument. You got a better one? Let me hear it. All right, and we'll go back and forth, and we'll see who wins. And I got to tell you, in 20-plus years on Fox and in the last year and a half on BillO'Reilly.com, nobody ever beat me.
All right, well, let me ask you that.
There were a couple of draws. Charles Krauthammer, the late Charles Krauthammer, and I had some epic debates.
Yeah.
But nobody ever beat me.
What?
Because I would go in armed and dangerous with facts.
Right.
And with historical context. But now it's too annoying. You know, people, I don't want to hear that. I want to hear what I believe. No matter, my belief may be fallacious. It may be wrong. It may be based on nothing. But I don't want to hear the opposite.
Because we want to be affirmed.
Yes, that's what you see on TV now.
Yeah.
So MSNBC, CNN, you hate Trump, that's where you go. You like Trump, you go to Fox. Yeah. You hate Trump, you go to the networks. All three of them hate Trump. So Fox prospers because it's the only one that doesn't hate him.
Yeah.
And so there it is. And does that do anybody any good? I don't think so, but that's what we have.
Bill, you obviously have got these books that you've written. What are you reading right now? Like, what is it that Bill O'Reilly turns to?
I'm reading the bio of Bill Belichick.
Okay.
The New England Patriots coach.
Anything particular you've learned or you've gleaned from that?
Yeah, I mean, I always read books about people at the top of their professions. I like to think that I, you know, in my 45 years, reached the top of the TV news. I think I did.
I'd say so.
And I learn from people who, you know, get to the top. How did they do it? Who are they? What price did they pay? So I'm reading that. And then there's a book by Bram Stoker's nephew called Dracul for Halloween. I got that. Dracula is one of the most vivid fictional characters in history. So I got a wide variety of stuff that I read. But it's got to grab me. I mean, I'm not giving you, you know, 2 hours of my time right. if I'm bored after page 10. So you got to get me.
Leland, I think we just found out the next killing is going to be trying to kill Dracula. I think that's the next Bill O'Reilly book. I think that's what it's going to be.
There you go.
Before we wrap it up with you, a lot of your life in broadcasting, I've been a broadcaster for 20 years. It involves prep. Cameron, not only broadcasting, but sports, prep.
Yep.
You have to write books. You got to prep. You mentioned going into debates, being armed with information.
In fact,
how important is that as a key to success, getting to the top of whatever field our listeners are in today? How important is prep as a component?
Well, if
to
you're
that?
A communicator, I mean, if you're making a living in an industry where you have to communicate to other people, you have to convince them to buy your product, convince them to do something that enhances your business, then you have to go in with a very well thought out strategy. Right? So who am I trying to convince? What are their interests? You always have to get into their interests. So what I did, and the reason that I became the most watched cable news guy in the country, in the world really, because we were in so many countries, was that I said, all right, who's watching me? That's where I started. Who's watching? And primarily working class people were watching because I'm a working class person. I didn't get the pinheads in San Francisco, the Manhattan socialites. I mean, I'm a barbarian to them, so they're not watching me. But the working class people in Kentucky and everywhere else were. Okay, so what are their needs? What are they interested in? And I came to a conclusion very early in my commentary career that people wanted honest information.
Yep.
That they may not like it, they may disagree with it, but they wanted to know it. And that's what I centered my presentation in. And I tell anybody listening to this podcast, if you're in business and you have to communicate, you've got to figure out what the person needs, all right, what they need. And then don't pander, you don't pander, but you try to figure it out and then give it to them. And then they'll be your customer or they're your adherent or whatever forever, because they'll respect that.
The book, Killing the SS, what is your favorite chapter in it? What is the
last chapter is amazing. I mean, I'm really proud of that chapter, and it just goes into an area that nobody could ever suspect.
He's just making me want to skip
exciting,
ahead.
And that's how we close the book.
He's making me want to skip ahead to the end, Bill.
No, I think you need this. I think you need all of it. You got a lot of beach time coming up. So, the other side of this too. I mean, your whole series is awesome. These are all available Amazon.com. You mentioned top of the bestseller list right now.
Right, we're number one New York Times bestseller list coming Sunday. You get the book in Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, BillO'Reilly.com. We'll give you a little gift if you buy it from us.
All right.
Awesome.
And so I hope people do. Yeah. They'll like it.
Well, it's been terrific talking to you again. Thank you so much for your time. The book,
okay,
Killing
guys,
the
best
SS.
Of luck.
You too. You right. too as well. Killing the SS, The Hunt for the Worst War Criminals in History. Wow. That was pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, listen, our little podcast, having Mr. Bill O'Reilly on, absolutely. And what I love is there are two things I love I love documentaries. You and I've talked about this before. I could eat up documentaries because so many of them are things I don't know about, and then so many of them are historically based.
Right.
And I literally, and I'm not kidding, you can look at my phone right now and see what I'm watching on Hulu. Hulu, I kind of leave that one there for my King of the Hill and Family Guy, and you know, those are my play shows.
Right.
But if I'm watching, you know, it's Amazon Prime and Netflix, and it's all documentaries, and I guarantee you, half of them are based on World War II right now.
Yeah,
and I cannot get enough of that part of our life because so much of what happened is scary and fascinating. And how did we ever get to this point? And the cool thing about World War II. Is that it's all based on World War One?
Well,
it was basically a 40-year war that never ended.
Right, and
had a big 20-year pause in the middle, but all based on the same thing.
And not only that, but it also was it ushered in a societal shift globally. From that time forward,
oh sure.
From that time forward, we've not had, and probably will never have, a conventional showdown in the way that those two wars had. Now, we had, obviously, Vietnam was conventional, but it was still unconventional, and Korea was not the same, and going ahead to Afghanistan and these other wars, and now we fight wars differently. And it ushered in a period of prosperity and peace that allowed us to build a machine that that made America what it is today. So,
And I think the whole idea behind Bill's book, the essays, because there's so many people that if you really dig, and I'm anxious to dig into this and find out his perspective and his researcher's perspective, but if there's so many people that, look, Hitler sometimes was very much, he was about power.
Yeah.
And sometimes he was about blaming the Jews. Sometimes he was pushed to blame the Jews by Goebbels and by some of his other lackeys. Some of these people that basically ran these concentration camps, some of them were hardcore Nazis. Some of them weren't and had problems with what they were doing.
Right.
And that's why I think it's fascinating to find out, okay, how do you track down? Now, if they were part of the extermination, does it matter whether they are hardcore or not? No.
Right.
They were part of extermination of a race of people. But bottom line is that there were so many people that kind of were half-hearted or no-hearted when it came to what the Nazis were doing. And that's just fascinating to try to figure out where they lined up in that.
But there's an interesting study that's come out of all of this, and it is it's the study of how people who normally would go about their life can be dragged into, because there were people that were involved in essentially the Holocaust that were, you know, they, in their prior lives, they didn't wake up thinking, I need to kill all kinds of Jews. They were brought into this, and the study is around the concept and the danger. And this is what scares me, branching this into the conversation, off the conversation we had with Bill.
Right.
Groupthink. Mm. What happens when you live in a world where all of your points of view are only affirmed? And what ends up happening, you know, people become capable of things we could never imagine they were capable of when they're locked in an echo chamber. And what terrifies me about the setting that we live in right now is we have all these different information sources, but everybody burrows into this tunnel. And they get locked into this echo chamber. Yep. And you wonder, how can a guy cover his van with stickers and send bombs to Democrats? Right. How can a guy who loves Bernie Sanders walk with a semi-automatic rifle and try to kill a bunch of Republicans who are just trying to practice for a charity baseball game? How can somebody who otherwise never indicated they would do that before do that all of a sudden? Yeah. They do it because they got trapped in an echo chamber of groupthink. Affirmed, reaffirmed, reaffirmed. Back to your point, no accountability.
So it goes back to, in some sense, it goes back to ego. It goes back to self-esteem.
And ignorance.
Is that we like to have people tell us that our belief system is right. Let's look about, okay, you and I are both Christians.
Right.
Okay? All right, and we look about one of the hardest things as a Christian is to share our faith with someone else. Now, if I get in front of 5,000 people when I preach, I can easily do it.
Right.
Okay? But when I get into a one-on-one conversation with someone, it's difficult to do. I remember the conversation you, me, and your dad had on the way back from the Grand Canyon. That was a difficult conversation where you've got three Christians, actually four if we count your nephew, and we're talking about the difficult parts of our faith.
Right.
And that was an uncomfortable, difficult conversation because none of us had the answer to the question that was asked. And I think a lot of times that's what we're afraid of. We're afraid of not knowing the answer when the answer should be, I don't know, but I want to know more.
Well,
and that's why I love, and one thing I wanted to ask Bill that I didn't get to, because I think it's pretty well stated in his belief system, as he said, well, he's a history teacher at one point, is that that's why history matters so much.
Yeah.
Is that you learn, you get to see mistakes that were made. And I know that's cliche, but you do. You get to see what works, what didn't work, what would work in this sort of, you know, agrarian society. I know I messed it up. Edit that out for me. You get to see how things, why we have the things we have, how they came about. You brought up perfectly Lincoln. What would have had it? I mean, the idea that Lincoln basically, the South, in some sense, was treasonous in what they did, and Lincoln pardoned them all.
Right.
If we go back and think about what that means for him to say, you're forgiven and you're still part of, he held this country together. That's enormous.
We're going to have an episode on racial relations coming up.
Yep.
And one of the things that I think about, because I'm fascinated by Lincoln.
Hard not to be.
Yeah. And his leadership. And I often wonder what would have happened to America if he had not been killed. And how much sooner? Because a lot of, like, when you look at the geographical divide between North and South in America,
yeah,
and a lot of the cultural anachronisms of the South,
ooh, anachronism,
if you will,
better than agrarian,
a lot of that sort of separatist feeling. I'm a Southerner.
Mm-hmm.
I'm proud to be a Southerner.
I am too.
I'm proud of the heritage and history of the part of the nation that I grew up in and my family and all of this. But I'm glad the South lost. I would like to think that if, yes, I were in that time period, I would have chosen to fight with the North. But my point is, a lot of what ended up happening when you drove those hard divides, feeling, again, this goes right back to what I said.
Yeah,
you burrow into the tunnel. The Southerners were treated atrociously after President Lincoln was, yeah, killed, and in what kind of attitudes came out of that that led to the awfulness that came, right, out of there in the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah.
So my question is, what if the civil rights movement had been completed 20 or 15 or 10 years after the Civil War was over?
Yeah.
What would have happened if there was reconciliation? How much easier would it have been for us to be standing in an America right now where everyone is treated equal and viewed equally, as Martin Luther King wanted, by the character of
their character
instead of the color of their skin?
That's right.
I wonder about that all the time. But I think that ties back to that whole, we get into that divisiveness, we, yeah, get into that groupthink at our peril.
Well, I mentioned this before on this very podcast, because I always go back to this. It's what James Mattis, our Secretary of Defense, once said, and he was talking about this very thing, the divisiveness, yeah, of our country. I think you're saying it correctly. I just say it the
knows?
Way I say it the way I like to say it, like agrarian.
Did you know irregardless is not a word?
I did know that. Regardless, I did know that.
Let's move on.
Yeah. But what he said was, he goes, you have to be willing to be persuaded.
Right.
And that is where we are not as a country. And now, here's what I would say, though. I would say we're not that way on social media. We get on social media and we regardless of how many facts are put in our face, we will not back down.
Yeah.
We will lie. We will say other things. It doesn't matter. And with all the facts and the proof, and we'll ask for, well, can you show me the article? Can you show me the peer review thing? Okay. Well, here it is. Well, because we don't like to be told that we're wrong. And, yeah, what James Mattis says is, you have to be willing to be persuaded. You have to go into a conversation with someone you disagree with and be willing to say, this is what I believe. And I believe it. I am heartfelt in my belief, but I'm willing to put what I believe on the line to discuss with you as an adult,
right,
and listen to your thoughts, your ideas, your beliefs, and what your truths are. And I hate that phrase, my truth and your truth, but to hear what your truths are and what you believe. And I'm willing to hear you.
Right.
I'm willing to say, okay, maybe I've got this part wrong. And that's something we're not doing as a country right now, at least on social media. Now, when we get out here and we have conversations and it's one-on-one and it's more personal, and all of a sudden you don't want to look like an ass in front of someone else.
Right.
The anonymity of social media brings, yeah, a lot of ugliness to the table.
It does.
And when you're in front of someone that that thinks and speaks and says and sounds and believes differently than you, it is so much easier to offer them the respect,
right,
that we would want for ourselves in the same situation.
Totally agree with that. I don't believe that there's ever been a single debate or argument solved on Facebook, nor has
never
a single constructive conversation ever happened
on
Twitter.
I don't think anyone's basic philosophy has, yeah, ever changed based on social media.
Maybe
debate.
That's an argument we should use it less.
Maybe. Well, and you know what? It's a point. I've just stopped being political. I think I did, yeah, one thing a few weeks ago. That's when Hillary made her little comment about, well, they all look the same,
yeah,
which I had people tell me she was just joking. She may well have been.
Right.
But had someone else said that, you or I, whether we were joking or not, it wouldn't have
you
been.
You were pointing out the double standard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And other than that, I can't remember the last time I got political on Twitter, because,
yeah,
it doesn't matter. No one's listening. We are all just in our. So I just use it as advertising.
Yeah.
For example, today,
yeah,
I've got my documentary free of charge. Anyone go watch? Anyone go watch the documentary free of charge today on Election Day? But they're not going to hear this till later. So
right,
anyway.
It's all good. Listen, fantastic conversation. I think
that was fun.
Bill started something fun there.
Yeah,
we've got lots of great episodes still coming up.
I've never read any of his killing books, and I'm not a reader, but I love history, and,
yeah,
and I can't wait to dive into especially this one, because I'm such a World War II Ophile.
Yeah. You'll have have fun. He's a great writer. We'll continue more of the Disruption Zone. Make sure you remember you can download us on iTunes and Google Play. Many thanks to Hunter Mitchell, our photographer.
Absolutely. And DisruptionZone.com.
DisruptionZone.com. We're on Twitter at the Disruption Zone. Twitter is Zone Disruption.
Zone Disruption.
We're on Instagram at the Disruption Zone.
Facebook.
And Facebook.
So all the social media
Zone.
Where we decided things
we're
can't
on
be.
On there.
Right. Where we decided things can't be fixed. All right. We're there.
And thanks to iHeartMedia as well. I'm Leland Conway with Cameron Mills on the Disruption Zone.